thousands of horses. I don't tell Cassius this, but I am afraid. The Highlands feel safe, but just out there in the landscape beyond are roving bands of psychotic godlings, godlings I do not want to run across quite yet. The thought of meeting other houses is made all the more terrible by the idea that even home is not safe. It's like Octavia Auloon always says, no man can pursue any endeavour in the face of tribal warfare. We can't afford to leave Titus alone for too long. He's already stolen berries Leah and Quinn collected. And this morning he tried to use the standard on Quinn to see if it could make slaves for his raiding parties out of the house's own members. It couldn't. We have to bind the house together somehow, Cassius tells me as we scout the northern highlands. The Institute is with us for the rest of our lives. If we lose, we may never gain position. Ever. And if we're enslaved during the course of the game? I ask. He looks worriedly over at me. What worse loss could there be? As if I needed more motivation. Your father won his year, I wager. He was primus, I ask.
To be an imperator, he'd have to have won his year.
Right. Always knew he won his year, though I had no slagging idea what that meant till we got here. We both agree that in order to bind our house back together, Titus must go. But it is futile to fight him outright. That chance passed after the first day. His tribe has grown too large. I say we kill him in his sleep, Cassius suggests. You and I could do it. His words chill me. We make no decision, yet the proposition serves to remind me that he and I are different creatures. Or are we really? His wrath is a cruel, cold thing. Yet I never see the anger again, not even around Titus. He's all smiles and laughter and challenging members of Titus's pack to races and wrestling when they aren't going out on raids. Just as I am around my enemies. Yet, while I'm regarded warily by most, Cassius is loved by all except Titus's pack. He's even started sneaking off with Quinn. I like her. She killed a deer with a trap, then told a story about how she killed the thing with her teeth. Even showed us evidence. Hair between her teeth and gums along with bite marks on the deer. We thought we had a prettier Severo on our hands, till she laughed too hard to go on with the tall tale. Cassius helped her get the deer hair out of her teeth. I like a committed liar. Conditions worsen in the first few days. People remain hungry because we've yet to build a fire in the castle, and hygiene is quickly forgotten when two of our girls are snatched up by Ceres' horsemen as they bathe in the river just beneath our gate. The gulls are confused when even their fine pores begin clogging, and they gain pimples. Looks like a bee sting, Roke laughs to Cassius and me. Or a radial distant sun. I pretend to be fascinated by it, as though I didn't have them all my red life. Cassius leans forward to inspect it. Brother man, that is just... Then Roke pops the pimple right into Cassius's face, causing him to reel back and gag from disgust. Quinn falls over giggling. I do wonder sometimes, Roke begins, after Cassius has recovered, as to the purpose of all this. How can this be the most efficient method of testing our merit, of making us into beings who can rule the society? And do you ever come to a conclusion? Cassius asks warily. He keeps his distance now. Poets never do, I say. Roke chuckles. Unlike most poets, I sometimes manage. And I have our answer to this. Spit it out, Cassius urges. As though I wasn't going to without instruction from our resident prima donna, Roke sighs. They have us here because this valley was humanity before gold ruled. Fractured. Disunited, even in our very own tribe. They want us to go through the process that our forefathers went through. Step by step, this game will evolve to teach us new lessons. Hierarchies within the game will develop. We'll have reds, golds, coppers. Pinks? Cassius asks hopefully.
Makes sense, I say.
Oh, that would be ripe strange, Cassius laughs, twisting his wolf ring on his finger. Mothers and fathers would be throwing fits if that went on. Probably why Titus leers at the girls. He likely wants a toy. Speaking of toys, where did he send Vixus?
I laugh.
Vixus, likely the most dangerous of Titus's followers, and the others, departed nearly 2 hours ago on Titus's orders to use Phobos Tower's height advantage to scout the plains in preparation for a raid on House Ceres. It'd be best to have Vixus on our side if we make a play, I say. He's Titus's right hand. Roke continues on a different train of thought.
I don't know about pinks, Roke says.
The idea of a gold being a pink offends him.
But the rest is simple.
This is a microcosm of the solar system. Seems to me like capture the flag with swords, if you recall that game, I reply. I never played the sport, but my studying with Matteo brought me up to speed on the games these children played in their parents' gardens.
Mm-hmm,
Cassius nods. He shoves a mock-serious finger in Rogue's chest. Agreed. So you can take your quick talk and put it where the sun dare not shine, Rogue. We two great minds have decided. It's a game of capture the flag.
I see, Rogue laughs. Not all men can understand metaphor and subtlety like me. But do not fear, muscular friends. I will be here to guide you through the mind-bending things. For instance, I can tell you that our first test will be to piece the house back together again before an enemy comes a-knocking.
Hell, I mutter, looking out over the edge of the parapet.
Something in your bum? Cassius asks.
Looks like the game just started. I point downward. Across the glen, just where the forest meets the grass plain, Vixus drags a girl by her hair, the first slave of House Mars. And far from being revolted, I'm jealous. Jealous that I did not capture her. Titus's minion did. And that means that Titus now wields credibility.
Chapter 23. Fracture. Though we all still sleep under the same roof, it took only 4 days for the house to dissolve into 4 tribes. Antonia, apparently the scion of a family that owns a sizable asteroid belt, gets the midrafters, the talkers, the whiners, the brains, the dependents, the wimps, the snobs, and the politicos. Titus draws mostly high drafts or midrafts, the physical specimens, the violent, the fast, the intrepid, the prototypically intelligent, the ambitious, the opportunists, the obvious selection for House Mars. The prodigy pianist, quiet Cassandra, is his. So is raspy Pollux, and the psychotic Vixus, who shivers with pleasure at the mere idea of putting metal into flesh. If Cassius and I had been more political, we might have managed to steal the high drafts from Titus. Hell, we might have had everyone ready to follow, if we just told them they had to obey. After all, Cassius and I were the strongest for a brief moment. But then we gave Titus time to intimidate, and Antonia time to manipulate. Damned Antonia, I say. Cassius laughs and shakes his golden head as we bound east along the highlands in search of more hidden caches of supplies. My long legs can cover a kilometer in just over a minute.
Oh, you come to expect these things from us. If our families hadn't spent holidays together when we were little things, I might have called her out as a Democrat on the first day, but she's hardly that. More like Caesar, or... what do they call them? Presidents?
A tyrant in necessity's clothing.
She's a turd in the swill bowl, I say.
What the gory slag does that mean?
Cassius laughs. Uncle Nero could have told him. Sorry? Oh, heard it in Yorkton once from a high red. Means she's a fly in the wine.
A high red?
Cassius snorts. One of my nannies was a high red. I know. Odd. Should have been a brown. But the woman would tell me stories as I tried to go to sleep.
That's nice, I say.
I thought her an uppity bugger. Tried to tell Mother to make her shut up and leave me alone, because all she wanted to do was talk about veils and dreary romances that always ended in some sort of sadness. Depressing creature.
What does your mother do when you complained?
Mother? Ha! She clapped me on the head and said, there's always something to learn from anybody, even a high red. She and Father like to pretend they're progressives. Confuses me.
He shakes his head.
But Yorkton?
Julian couldn't believe you were from Yorkton.
The darkness returns in me. Even thinking of Io doesn't dispel it. Even thinking of my noble mission and all the license it gives me doesn't banish the guilt. I am the only one who shouldn't feel guilty for the passage, yet, besides Roke, I think I'm the only one who does. I look at my hands and remember Julian's blood.
Cassius points up suddenly to the sky southwest of us.
What the gory hell?
Dozens of blinking medbots pouring from floating Olympus's castle. We hear their distant whine. Proctors flicker after them like flaming arrows toward the distant southern mountains. Whatever has happened, one thing is certain. Chaos reigns in the south.
Although my tribe continues to sleep in the castle, we've moved from the high tower to the gatehouse, so we don't have to rub shoulders with Titus's lot. To keep safe, we leave our cooking a secret. We meet our tribe for supper by a loch in the northern highlands. They're not all high drafts. We have some, Cassius and Roke, but then no one above 17th pick. We've some mid-drafts, Quinn and Leah, but the rest are the dregs. The low drafts. Clown, Screwface, Weed, Pebble, and Thistle. This bothers Cassius even though the dregs of the Institute are still certifiably superhuman compared with the rest of the colours. They are athletic. They are resilient. They never ask you to repeat yourself unless you are making a point. And they accept my orders, even anticipating what next I'll ask them to do. I credit their less privileged upbringings. Most are smarter than I, but I have that unique thing they call slang smarts, proven by my high score in the extrapolation intelligence test. Not that it matters. I have sulfur matches, and that makes me the god Prometheus. Neither Antonia nor Titus have fire, as far as I know, so I'm the only one who can fill bellies. I make each of my tribe kill goats or sheep. No one is allowed to freeload, even though Screwface tries his best. They don't notice my hands trembling when I cut my first goat's throat with a knife. There's so much trust in the beast's eyes, followed by confusion as it dies, still thinking me its friend. The blood is warm, like Julian's. The neck muscle tough. I have to saw with the dull knife. Just as Leah does when she kills her first sheep, squealing as she does it. I make her skin it, too, with Thistle's help. And when she cannot, I take her hands into my own and guide her along, giving her my strength.
Daddy going to have to cut up your meat for you, too?
Thistle taunts.
Shut it, Roke says.
She can fight her own battles, Roke. Leah. Thistle asked you a question.
Leah blinks over at me, wide eyes confused.
Ask her another, Thistle.
What's going to happen when we get in a tight spot with Titus? Will you squeal then too, child?
Thistle knows what I want her to do. I asked her to do it 30 minutes ago before I brought the goat to Leah. I motion my head at Leah, to Thistle.
You going to cry?
Thistle asks.
Wipe your eyes in...
Leah snarls and jumps at her. The two roll around, punching each other in the face. It's not long before Thistle's got Leah in a chokehold. Roke stirs beside me. Quinn pulls him back down. Leah's face goes purple, her hands slap at Thistle's. Then she passes out. I give Thistle a nod of thanks. The dark-faced girl gives a slow nod. Leah's shoulders are squarer the next morning. She even musters enough courage to hold Roke's hand. She also claimed to be a better cook than the rest of us. She isn't. Roke tries his hand, but he's hardly any better. Eating their grub is like taking down stringy, dry sponges. Even Quinn, with all her stories, can't muster up a recipe. We cook goat and deer meat over our camp kitchen 6 kilometres from the castle, and we do it at night in the gulches so the light and smoke cannot be seen. We do not kill the sheep, instead we collect and deposit them in a northern fort for safekeeping. I could bring more over to my tribe with the food, but the food is as big a danger as it is a boon. What Titus and his killers would do if he found that we had fire, food, clean water. I am returning to the castle with Roke from a scouting trip to the south, when we hear noises coming from a small grove of trees. Creeping closer, we hear grunts and hacking sounds. Expecting to see a wolf pack ravaging a goat, we peer through the brush and find 4 of Titus's soldiers squatting around a deer corpse. Their faces are bloody, eyes dark and ravenous as they tear strips out of the dead deer with their knives. 5 days without fire. 5 days of bad berries, and they've already turned into savages. We have to give them matches, Roke tells me afterward. The stones here don't spark with flint. No. If we give them matches, then Titus will have even more power. Does it matter at this point? They are going to get sick if they keep eating raw meat. They already are sick. So, they shit their pants, I grunt. There are worse things. Tell me, Darrow, would it be worse to have Titus in power and have Mars strong, or for Darrow to be in power with Mars weak? Better for whom? I ask petulantly. He only shakes his head. Let them rot their gory bellies, is Cassius's opinion. They made their beds, now let them shit in them. My army agrees. I am fond of my army, the dregs, the low drafts. They aren't as entitled or well-bred as the high drafts. Most remember to thank me when I give them food. At first they didn't. They don't prance off after Titus on midnight axe raids simply because it gets their jollies off. No, they follow us because Cassius is as charismatic as the sun and, in his light, the shadow I cast looks like it knows what it's doing. It doesn't. It, like me, was born in a mine. Still, it does seem like I have some strategy. I have us make maps of our territory on digislates we found in a waterlogged cellar at the bottom of a ravine. But we still have no weapons other than my sling blade and several knives and sharpened sticks, so whatever strategy we have is based on acquiring information. Funny thing is, only one tribe has a silver shit's idea of what is going on, and it's not ours. It's not Antonia's, and it sure as hell isn't Titus's. It's Severo's. And I'm nearly certain he's the only member in that tribe, unless he's adopted wolves by now. It's hard to say if he has or hasn't. Our house doesn't have family dinners. Though occasionally we'll see him running along the hillsides at night, in his wolfskin, looking, as Cassius put it best, like some sort of hairy demon child on hallucinogens. And once Roke even heard something, not a wolf, howling in the shrouded highlands. Some days, Severo walks around, all normalish, insulting everything that moves, except for Quinn. He makes an exception for her, delivering meats and edible mushrooms instead of insults. I think he's sweet on her, even though she's sweet on Cassius. We ask her to tell us stories about him, but she won't. She's loyal, and maybe that's why she reminds me of home. She's always telling good stories, most of them certainly gilded lies. A life spark is in her, just like the one that was in my wife. She's the last of us to call Goblin Severo. She's also the only one who knows where he lives. Even with all our scouting, we can't find a trace of where he sleeps. For all I know, he's out taking scalps beyond the highlands. I know Titus has sent scouts to stalk him, but I don't think they are successful. They can't even follow me. I know that rubs Titus raw.
I think he is wanking off in the bushes, Cassius chuckles, just waiting for us all to kill each other.
It's when Leah comes limping back to the castle that Roke seeks Cassius and me out. They beat her, he says. Not bad, but they kicked her in the stomach and took her day's labor.
Who? Cassius bristles. Who's the slagger?
Doesn't matter. What matters is they are hungry, so stop playing at an eye for an eye. This can't go on, Roke says. Titus's boys are starving. What do you expect they'd do? Hell, the big brute is hunting Goblin because he needs fire and food. If we just give that to him, we can unite the house, maintain civility. Maybe even Antonia will bring her tribe to reason.
Antonia? Reason?
Cassius asks, guffawing. Even if that happens, Titus will still be the most powerful, I say. And that's not the cure for anything.
Ah, yes, that's something you can't abide. Someone else having power.
Fine, then. Roke tugs at his long hair. Talk to Vixus or Pollux. Take away his captains if you must. But heal the house, Darrow. Otherwise we'll lose when another house comes knocking. On the sixth day, I take his advice. Knowing Titus is out raiding, I risk seeing Vixus in the keep. Unfortunately, Titus returns earlier than expected.
You're looking lively and spry, he says to me, before I can find Vixus in the keep's stone halls.
He blocks my path with his large body, shoulders nearly spanning the width of the hall. I feel another in the hallway behind me. Vixus, and two others. My stomach sinks a little. It was stupid to do this.
Where are you going, if I may ask?
I wanted to compare our scouting maps to the main map in the command room, I lie, knowing I have a digislate in my pocket.
Oh, you wanted to compare scouting maps to the main map? For the good of Mars, noble Darrow?
What other good is there? I ask. We are all on the same side. No?
Oh, we are on the same side, he says.
Titus booms an insincere laugh.
Vixus, if we are on the same side, don't you think it would be best if we shared his little maps with one another?
It would be for the very best, Vixus agrees. Mushrooms, maps, all the same.
So, he assaulted little Leah. His eyes are dead, like raven eyes.
Yes. So I'll take a look for you, Darrow.
Titus snatches the scouting maps from me. There's nothing I can do to stop him.
You're welcome to them, I say. So long as you know there are enemy fires to the far east and likely enemies in the great woods to the south. Raid all you like. Just don't get caught with your pants down.
Titus sniffs the air. He wasn't listening to me.
Since we are sharing, Darrow,
he sniffs again, closer to my neck.
Perhaps you'll share with us why you smell like wood smoke.
I stiffen, not knowing what to do.
Look at him squirm. Look at him weave a lie.
Titus's voice is all disgust. I can smell your deceit. Smell the lies dripping from you like sweat.
Like a woman in heat,
Pollux says sardonically. He shrugs apologetically at me.
Disgusting,
Vixus sneers.
He's a vile thing, a wretched womanish thing.
I don't know why I thought I'd be able to turn him on Titus.
You're a little parasite, Titus continues, nibbling away at morale because you will not come to heel, waiting for my noble boys and girls to starve.
They're closing in on me from behind, from the sides. Titus is huge. Pollux and Vixus are cruel, nearly as big as I.
You're a wretched creature, a worm in our spine.
I shrug, casually, trying to let them think I'm not worried. We can fix this, I say.
Oh?
Titus asks. The solution is simple, big man, I counsel. Bring your boys and girls home. Stop raiding Ceres every day before some other house comes in and slaughters you all. Then we'll talk about fire, about food.
You think you can tell us what to do, Darrow? That's the thrust of it?
Vixus asks.
Think you're better because you scored higher on the stupid little test, because the proctors chose you first?
He does,
Titus chuckles. He thinks he deserves Primus. Vixus's hawkish face leans close to mine, lips sneering each word. Handsome in repose, his lips peel back cruelly now, and his breath stinks as he looks me over, measuring me and trying to make me think he's not impressed. He snorts a contemptuous laugh. I see him shifting his head to spit in my face. I let him. The glob of phlegm hits, and it drips slowly down my cheek toward my lips. Titus watches with a wolfish smile. His eyes glimmer. Vixus looks to him for encouragement. Pollux comes closer.
You're a pampered little prick, Vixus says.
His nose nearly brushes mine.
So that's what I'm gonna take from you, Goodman. Your little prick.
Or you could let me leave, I say. You seem to be blocking the door.
Oh-ho!
He laughs, looking at his master.
He's trying to show he's not afraid, Titus. Trying to avoid a fight.
He looks at me with those golden, dead eyes.
I've broken uppity boys like you in the dueling clubs 1,000 times.
You have? I ask, incredulously.
Broken them like twigs, and then taken their girls for sport. What embarrassments I've made of them in front of their fathers, what weeping messes I make of boys like you.
Oh, Vixus, I say with a sigh, keeping the tremble of anger and fear out of my voice. Vixus, Vixus, Vixus. There are no boys like me.
I look back at Titus to make sure our eyes are joined, when I casually, as if I were dancing, loop my Helldiver hand around and slam it into the side of Vixus's neck at the jugular with the force of a sledgehammer strike. It ruins him. Yet I hit him with an elbow, a knee, my other hand, as he falls. Had his legs been anchored better, the first strike might have snapped his neck in half. Instead, he cartwheels sideways in the low gravity, going horizontal and shuddering from my raining blows as he hits the ground. His eyes go blank. Fear rises in my belly. My body is so strong. Titus and the others are too startled by the sudden violence to stop me as I spin past their outstretched hands and run down the halls.
I did not kill him. I did not kill him.
Chapter 24. Titus's War.
I did not kill Vixus.
but I killed the chance of uniting the house. I sprint down the keep's winding stairwells, shouts behind me. I pass Titus's lounging students. They're sharing bits of raw fish they managed to spear from the river. They could trip me if they knew what I've done. Two girls watch me go by and, hearing their leader's shouts, are too late in moving. I'm past their hands, past the keep's lower gatehouse, and into the main square of the castle. Cassius! I call up at the gatehouse to the castle where my men sleep. Cassius! He peeks his head out the window and sees my face. Oh, shit! Roke! He shouts. It's happened! Raise the dregs! Three of Titus's boys and one of his girls chase after me across the courtyard. They're slower than I, but another is coming from their post on the wall to cut me off. Cassandra. Her short hair jingles with bits of metal she's woven in. Effortlessly, she hops down the 8 meters from the parapet, an axe in hand, and races to intersect my path before I reach the stairs. Her golden wolf ring glimmers in the ebbing light. She's a beautiful sight. Then my entire tribe pours out of the gatehouse. They bring their makeshift packs, their knives, and the beating sticks we carved from felled branches taken from our woods. But they do not set toward me. They are bright, so they crank open the huge double gates that separate the castle from the long sloping path leading down to the glen. Mist seeps through the open gate, and they disappear into the murk. Only Quinn is left behind. Quinn, the fastest of Mars. She bounds along the cobblestone like a gazelle, coming to my aid. Her beating stick twirls in the air. Cassandra doesn't see her. A long, golden ponytail flops in the chill night air as Quinn winds up, a smile on her face, and blindsides Cassandra from the flank, hitting her full force in the knee with her beating stick. The crack of the wood on strong gold bone is loud. So is Cassandra's scream. Her leg doesn't break, but she flips onto the cobblestone. Quinn does not slow her stride. She swoops in beside me, and together we leave Titus's pack behind. We catch up with the others in the bowl of the glen. Setting across the rugged hills, we aim toward our northern fort in the deep mist-shrouded highlands. Vapor clings to our hair, dripping off in pearls. We reach the fort well past midnight. It is a cavernous, barren tower that leans over a ravine like a drunken wizard. Lichen covers the thick, grey stone. Mist swaddles its parapets, and we make our first meal of the birds in the eaves of the single tower. Some escape. I hear their wings in the dark night. Our civil war has begun. Unfortunately, Titus is not a stupid enemy. He does not come for us as we thought he would. I had hoped he would come try and lay siege to our north fort, that his army would see our fires inside the stone walls and smell the meat as it sizzled in fat. The sheep we gathered earlier would have lasted us weeks, months, if we had water. We could have feasted every night. They would have broken then. They would have left Titus behind. But Titus knows of my weapon, fire, so he avoids us so that his boys and girls cannot see what luxuries we have. He does not let his tribe alone long enough to think. Frenzy, war, numb the sense in man. So they raid House Ceres from the 6th day on, and he creates trophies for acts of bravery and violence, giving boys and girls marks in blood on their cheeks that they bear proudly. We slink along, watching their war parties from the brush and the tall grasses of the plains. Sometimes we gain a vantage on the southern highland peaks near Phobos. From there, we witness the siege of House Ceres. Around House Ceres, the smoke rises in a sullen crown. Apple trees are hewn down, horses stolen. Titus's raiders even lasso a torch from one of the Ceres ramparts in an attempt to bring fire to Mars's castle. Ceres' horsemen ride them down with pails of water before they reach home. Titus shrieks in rage when this happens, and the Ceres' horses fly by, dashing the flame with water before circling home. With his best soldier, Vixus, he upends one of the horses with a tree branch fashioned like a pike. The rider spills from the saddle, and Pollux is on her. They take two more slaves that day, and Titus takes the horse for himself. It is on our eighth day that the Institute and I watched the siege with Cassius and Roque from the highlands. Today, Titus rides the captured horse beneath the wall of House Ceres with a lasso, daring their archers to shoot their arrows at him and his horse. One poor girl leans her head out to get a better angle with her bow. She draws the arrow back to her ear, aims, and just before she's about to loose the arrow, Titus hurls his lasso upward. It flails through the air. She jerks back. Not fast enough. The lasso loops her neck, and Titus kicks his horse away from the wall, tightening the lasso. Her friends scramble to grab her. They hold tight, but are forced to let go before her neck snaps. Her friends' screams echo across the plains as she's jerked violently down from the top of the wall and dragged by Titus back to his cheering followers. There, Cassandra kicks the girl to her knees and enslaves her with our standard. The flames from the burning crops lick up into the twilight, where several proctors hover with flagons of wine and a tray of some rare delicacy. "A violent heart set harshest flame," Roque murmurs from his knee. "He's bold," I say deferentially. "And he likes this." His eyes sparkled when I struck Vixus in the throat. Cassius nods along. "Too much." "He is lethal," Cassius agrees. "But he means something different." I look over at him. There's a raw edge to his voice. "And he's a liar."
"He is?" I ask.
"He didn't kill Priam."
Roque becomes quiet. Smaller than us, he seems a child as he remains on a knee. His long hair is held in a ponytail. Dirt crusts his nails, which scrabble in tying his shoes as he looks up.
"He didn't kill Priam," Cassius repeats.
The wind moans over the hills behind us. Night comes slow today. Cassius's cheeks sink into shadow. Still, he's handsome.
"They wouldn't have put Priam with a monster like Titus. Priam's a leader, not a warlord. They'd put Priam with someone easy, like one of our dregs."
I know where Cassius is going with this. It's in the way he watches Titus. The coldness in his eyes reminds me of a pit viper's gaze as it follows its prey. My insides turn sour as I do it, but I lead Cassius in the direction he seems to want to go, inviting him to bite. Roque tilts his head at me, noticing something strange in my interaction with Cassius. "And they would give Titus someone else," I say.
"Someone else,"
Cassius repeats, nodding. "Julian," he is thinking. He doesn't say it. Neither do I. Better to let it fester in his mind. Let my friend think our enemy killed his brother. This is a way out.
"Blood begets blood begets blood begets blood,"
Roque's words into the wind, which carries west towards the long plain and towards the flames that dance in the low horizon. Beyond, the mountains hunker, cold and dark. Snow already gathers on their peaks. It's a sight to steal one's breath, yet Roque's eyes never leave my face. I find it a small pleasure that Titus's slaves are not very effective allies for him. Far from being indoctrinated as thoroughly as a red might be, these newly made slaves are stubborn creatures. They follow orders or risk being labelled shamed after graduation, but they purposefully never do more or less than he demands. It is their act of rebellion. They fight where he tells them to fight, whom he tells them to fight,
even when they should retreat. They gather the berries he shows them, even if they know they are poisonous, and pile stones till the pile falls over. But if there is an open gate leading to the enemy's fortress, and Titus doesn't tell them to go into it, they'll stand there and pick their butts. Despite the addition of slaves and the raising of Ceres's crops and orchards, Titus's force, which is quite sound at violence, is pitiful when they attempt to do anything else. His men empty their bowels in shallow latrines, or behind trees, or in the river, in an attempt to poison the students of House Ceres. One of his girls even falls in, after emptying her bowels into the water. She flails around in her own waste. It's a scene of comedy, but laughter has become seldom, except from the students of Ceres. They sit behind their high walls, and catch fish from the river, and eat breads from their ovens and honey from their apiaries. In response to the laughter, Titus drags one of the male slaves up in front of the gate. The slave is a tall one, with a long nose and a mischievous smile meant for the ladies. He thinks this is all a game till Titus cuts off one of his ears. Then he cries for his mother like a young child. He will never command warships. The proctors, even House Ceres's, do not stop the violence. They watch from the sky in twos and threes, floating about as medbots wind down from Olympus to cauterize a wound or treat severe head trauma. On the 20th morning of the Institute, the defenders throw a basket of bread loaves down as Titus's men attempt to batter in the tall gate with a felled tree. The besiegers end up fighting each other for the food, only to find that the bread was baked around razor blades. The screams last till the afternoon. Titus's reply comes just before night falls. With five newly minted slaves, including the male with the missing ear, he approaches the gate till he's near a mile off. He parades in front of the slaves, holding four long sticks in his hand. These he gives to each of the slaves, except the girl he pulls down from the ramparts with a lasso. With a low bow to the Ceres gate, he waves a hand and orders the slaves to commence beating the girl. Like Titus, she is tall and powerful, so it is difficult to pity her. At first. The slaves hit the girl gingerly with the initial swings. Then Titus reminds them of the shame that will forever mark their names if they do not obey. They swing harder. They aim for the girl's golden head. They hit her, and hit her, till her shouts have long faded, and blood mats her blonde hair. When Titus grows bored, he drags the wounded girl back to his camp by her hair. She slides limply over the earth. We watch from our place in the highlands, and it takes Leah and Quinn both to stop Cassius from sprinting down into the plains. The girl will live, I tell him. The sticks are all show. Roke spits bitterly into the grass and reaches for Leah's hand. It's odd seeing her give him strength. The next morning we discover that Titus's reply did not stop with the beating. After we retire to our castle, Titus snuck back in the dead of night to hide the girl directly in front of the Ceres gate underneath a thick blanket of grass, gagged and tied. Then he had one of his female followers shriek during the night to pretend she was the slave at the camp. She screamed of rape and violations. Maybe the captured Ceres girl thought she was safe under the grass. Maybe she thought the proctors would save her, and she would go home to mother and father, home to her equestrian lessons, home to her puppies and her books. But in the early dark of morning, she is trampled as riders, enraged by the fake screams, gallop from the Ceres fortress to rescue her from Titus's makeshift camp. They only learn of their folly when they hear the medbots descending behind them to carry her broken body up to Olympus. She never returns. Still, the proctors do not interfere. I'm not sure why they even exist. I miss home. Lycos, of course, but also the place where I was safe with Dancer Mateo. and harmony.
Soon there are no more slaves to take. House Ceres does not come out after dark any more, and their high walls are guarded. The trees outside the wall have all been cut down, but there are crops and more orchards inside their long walls. Bread still bakes, and the river still flows within their ramparts. Titus can do nothing but savage their land and steal what remains of their apples. Most have been sown with needles and stingers from wasps. Titus has failed, and so, as do those of any tyrant after a failed war, his eyes turn inward.
Chapter 25. Tribal War.
30 days into the Institute, and I've not seen evidence of another enemy house, except for the smoke signs of distant fires. House Ceres' soldiers roam the eastern fringes of our land. They ride with impunity now that Titus's tribe has retreated into our castle. Castle? No, it has become a hovel. I come upon it with Roke in the early morning. Fog still clings to the four spires, and light struggles to penetrate the dreary sky of our highland climate. Sounds from inside the stone walls echo into the quiet morning, like coins rattling about in a tin can. Titus's voice. He's cursing at his tribesmen to get up. Apparently, few do. Someone tells him to go slag himself, and it's little wonder. The bunk beds are the only real amenity the castle has, no doubt put there to encourage slothfulness. My tribe has no such amenities. We sleep on stone, curled next to one another, around our crackling fires. Oh, what I'd give for a bed again. Cassius and I slink along the slanted dirt road that leads to the gatehouse. We can hardly even see it, the fog is so thick. More sounds from inside. It seems like the slaves are up. I hear coughs, grumbling, and a few shouts. A long creak and the clatter of chains means the gate is opening. Cassius pulls me off to the side of the road, tucking us into the mist as the slaves shuffle past. Their faces are pallid in the low light. Hollows make homes in their sunken cheeks, and their hair has been dirtied. Mud-caked skin around their sigils. He passes near enough to me that I smell his body odor. I stiffen suddenly, worried he will again smell the smoke on me. But he doesn't. Beside me, Cassius is quiet, yet I feel his anger. We sneak back down the path and watch the slaves toil from the relative safety of the woods. They are not aureates as they scrub shit and scavenge for berries in the sharp thistle bushes. One or two are missing ears. Vixus, recovered from my attack except for a huge purple bruise on his neck, walks around slapping at them with a long stick. If the test is to unite a fractious house, I am failing. As early morning fades, and appetites change with the arrival of warm sunshine, Cassius and I hear a sound that makes our skin prickle. Screams. Screams from the high tower of Mars. They are a particular sort, a kind to darken the spirits. When I was a boy in Lycos, my mother was serving me soup at our stone family table the night of a laurel tide. It was a year after my father died. Kieran and Liana sat with me, neither yet older than 10. A single light unit flickered on and off above the table, so Mum was shrouded in darkness, except for her arm from the elbow down. Then came the scream, muffled by distance and the twists of our cavern township. I still see how the broth quivered in the ladle, how my mother's hand shook when she heard it. Screams. Not of pain, but of horror.
What he's doing to the girls!
Cassius hisses to me as we slink away from the castle as night descends.
He's a beast.
This is war, I say, though the words sound hollow,
even in my own ears.
It's school,
he reminds me.
What if Titus did this to our girls? To Leah? To Quinn?
I say nothing.
We would kill him,
Cassius answers for me.
We would kill him, cut his prick off and shove it in his mouth.
And I know he's also thinking of what Titus must have done to Julian. Despite Cassius's mutterings, I take his arm and pull him away from the castle. The gates are locked against the night. There is nothing we can do. I feel helpless again. Helpless as when Ugly Dan took Io from me. But I am different now. My hands turn to fists, and I am more than I was then. On our way back to our north fort, I see a glimmer in the air. Golden grav boots shimmer as Fichtner descends. He's chewing gum and holds his heart when he sees our evil glances.
Whatever did I do, young friends, to earn such glares? He's treating the girls like animals.
Cassius seethes. Veins in his neck stand out.
They are golds, and he is treating them like dogs, like pinks.
If he is treating them like pinks, then it is because they merited no better in this little world than pinks do in our big world.
You're joking!
Cassius can't understand.
They are golds, not pinks. He's a monster.
Then prove you're a man, and stop him,
Fichtner says.
As long as he's not murdering them one by one, it's not our concern. All wounds heal, even these.
That's a lie, I tell him. I'll never be healed of Io. That pain will last forever. Some things do not fade. Some things can never be made right.
Yet we do nothing because he has more fighters,
Cassius spits. An idea sweeps over me.
We can fix that.
Cassius turns to me. He hears the deadness in my voice just as I see it in his eyes when he speaks of Titus. That's a peculiar thing we share. We are made of fire and ice, though I am not sure which of us is ice and which is fire. Nevertheless, extremes rule us more than we'd like. That is why we are of Mars.
You have a plan, Cassius says.
I nod coldly.
Fichtner watches us two, and he grins. About Goridown time.
The plan starts with a concession only someone once a husband could make. Cassius cannot stop laughing when I tell him the details. Even Quinn snorts a laugh the next morning. Then she's off, running like a deer to Deimos Tower to bring my formal apology to Antonia. She's to meet me with Antonia's response at one of our supply caches near the Furor River, north of the castle. Cassius guards our new fort with the remainder of our tribe, in case Titus tries to attack while Roke and I go to the supply cache during the day. Quinn does not come. Dusk does. Despite the dark, we trace the path she would have taken from Deimos Tower. We go till we reach the tower itself, which sits in the low hills surrounded by thick woods. Five of Titus's men lounge around its base. Roke grabs me and pulls me down into the woods brush. He points to a tree 50 meters distant where Vixus sits hidden in wait on a high branch.
Did they catch Quinn?
No, she's too fast to be caught.
Did someone betray us?
We return to our fort by early morning. I'm sure I've been more tired, but I can't remember when. Blisters ruin my feet despite the fitted shoes, and my neck peels from long days in the sun. Something is wrong. Leah meets me by the fort's gate. She hugs Roke and looks up at me like I'm her father or something. She is not her usual timid self. Her bird-like body shakes, not from fear, but anger.
You have to kill that piece of filth, Darrow. You have to cut his slagging balls off.
Titus.
What happened? I look around. Leah, where is Cassius?
She tells me.
Titus captured Quinn as she was on her way back from the tower. They beat her. Then Titus sent one of her ears here. It was meant for me. They thought Quinn was my girl, and Titus thinks he knows my temper. They got the reaction they wanted, just not from me. Cassius was on watch, and as the others slept, he snuck away to the castle to challenge Titus. Somehow, the brilliant young man was arrogant enough to think hundreds of years of Oriat honor and tradition would survive the sickness that has consumed Titus's tribe in only a few weeks. The Imperator's son was wrong, and he is also unused to having his heritage be of such little consequence. In the real world, he would have been safe. In this small one, he is not.
But he's alive, I say.
Yeah, I'm alive, you pixie.
Cassius stumbles, shirtless, out of the fort.
Cassius!
Roke gasps. His face pales suddenly. Cassius's left eye is swollen shut. Lips are split. Ribs purple as grapes. His other eye is bloody. Three dislocated fingers shoot out like tree roots, and his shoulder is odd. The others stare at him with such sadness.
Cassius was the Imperator's boy, their shining knight. And now his body is a ruin.
And the looks upon their faces, the pallid cast to their skin, tell me that they have never before seen someone beautiful mutilated. I have.
He smells like piss. He tries to play it off as some lark. They beat the slag out of me when I challenged him, hit me with a shovel on the side of the head, then stood around and had themselves a circle piss. Then they tied me up in that stinko keep. But Pollock set me free like a good lad, and he's agreed to open the gate if we need it done.
I didn't think you were so stupid, I say.
Of course he is. He wants to be one of the Sovereign's knights, Roke mutters.
And all they do is duel. He shakes his long hair. Dirt crusts the leather band that holds it in a ponytail.
You should have waited for us.
What's done is done, I say. We go ahead with the plan.
Fine, Cassius snorts. But when the time comes, Titus is mine.
Chapter 26 Mustang. Part of Cassius is gone. That invincible boy I first met is somehow different. The humiliation changed him. I can't decide how, though, as I straighten his fingers and help him fix his shoulder. He falls down from the pain.
Thank you, brother,
he says to me, and cups the side of my head to help himself up. It is the first time he says it.
I failed the test.
I don't disagree with him.
I went in there like a plum fool. If this were anywhere else, they would have killed me.
At least it didn't cost you your life, I say.
Cassius chuckles. Just my pride.
Good. Something you have in abundance, Roke says with a smile.
We have to get her back.
Cassius's own grimace fades as he looks at Roke, then at me.
Quinn! We have to get her back before he takes her up to his tower.
We will. We bloody will. Cassius and I go east according to my plan, farther than we have gone before. We stay to the northern highlands, but we make sure we walk along the high crests visible to the open plains below. East and east, our long legs taking us fast and far. A rider to the southeast, I say. Cassius doesn't look. We pass through a humid glen,
where a dark lock offers us the chance to catch a drink across from a family of deerling. Mud covers our legs. Bugs flit over the cold water. The earth feels good between my fingers as I bend to drink. I dunk my head and join Cassius in eating some of our aging lamb. It needs salt. My belly cramps from all the protein.
How far east of the castle do you reckon we are? I ask Cassius, pointing behind him.
Maybe 20 clicks. Hard to peg it. Feels farther, but my legs are just tired.
He straightens and looks where I point.
Ah. Got it.
A girl on a dappled mustache.